Well, hey there, freaks. It's your boy, Marty Bent, a little hungover, a little ragged, in Dallas, recording this pre-roll ad for the Cash App. Hey, if you haven't downloaded the Cash App yet, what the hell are you thinking? Go to the App Store, whether it's the Google or the Apple App Store. Download the Cash App. Use the code STACKINGSATS, one word, STACINGSATS. You'll get $5, and then $5 is going to go to our very good friend, Al's Lacrosse in Chicago. And then after you get that $5, you're going to be able to use the Cash App for the Boost program. You're going to be able to buy Bitcoin. You're going to be able to send Bitcoin. You're going to be able to receive Bitcoin. And you're going to be able to do a bunch of shit. You're going to be able to customize your own card. You're going to be able to spend money places. You're going to be able to send Bitcoin to the app. Convert it to U.S. dollars if you're in a pinch. I don't advise that, but hey. Sometimes people get into trouble and you need to do some stuff. The Cash App is there for you. Must say, the coffee boost is not what it used to be. You have to go to the coffee shop 5 times before you get the dollar off. But do not fret. There are other merchants and other savings they can do via the Boost program. So go download the Cash App today at your local app store. Use the code STACKINGSATS. Get that $5 and start saving money and start stacking sats, thinking about your future. I think you guys are going to like this episode with Tur Demeester. We threw this together haphazardly. Not haphazardly, but last minute. Tur tapped me on the back and said, hey, I have an hour before I head back to Austin. Do you want to chat? And I said, a fucking course I want to chat, Tur. So here's our conversation. Enjoy. Okay. Tales from the Crypt. What is up, freaks? Welcome back to Tales from the Crypt. It's your boy, Marty Bent, here at a foreign studio in a hotel lobby, in a DoubleTree lobby in Dallas, Texas, sitting down with somebody I've been waiting to sit down with for years now that this podcast has been out. This interview came together last minute, so I'm very excited that it did come together. So we've got 45 minutes before our boy, Tur Demeester, has to catch a bus back to Austin. Tur, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Marty. Good to be here.
Thanks for coming on, man.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for nudging my arm and saying, hey, I have an hour. Let's
I think
do
last
this.
Time we tried to get together, it was like New York, and it was just one borough too far, I think, to make it work.
Yeah. Consensus week during that week in particular. It's never easy to coordinate schedules. There's too much stuff going on. But again, yeah, we only have 45 minutes here. Let's jump right into it. We did a little pre-interview prep. Let's get through the basic questions. You have been somebody who I've been reading for years now to learn more about Bitcoin. And I would like to know what drew you to Bitcoin in particular. How'd you find it? And what drove you to start Adamant Capital?
Yeah, so what drove me to Bitcoin, it was, I guess I want to say fear. I was scared of this, just learning about the history of money and banking. I was like, man, how is this long-term sustainable, like living at the heart of Europe? And seeing how little capital these banks had, and then also seeing the banking crisis happen, and Belgium had it one of the worst. Like, we had like 5 big banks that were teetering and needed to be restructured and bailed out. And to this day, they're still super like zombie banks, basically. Yeah. And so I was like, man, like this is like, you know, an economic nuclear winter that could potentially happen, especially if the euro starts breaking down or these government bonds start really, because it is the debt in Europe is just, you cannot pay it back. It's just a matter of when it's going to be unwound and be defaulted upon. So I was really like kind of freaked out. Like, how do I, you know, I'm here in my mid-20s. Like, how do I make sure that I'm not trapped and stuck here?
What were you doing at this point?
I was working on like, some academic papers. I was translating books. I was all kinds of things. I sold shoes, like really just whatever to pay the bills. I built some websites because I had dropped out of university, but I was still kind of, I wanted this intellectual career. I just didn't know how to make it happen outside of the university. And then it just kind of accumulated into writing about current affairs, economics, really trying to, for myself, just trying to understand what's going on, what should I do. And then that turned into a newsletter. And with the newsletter, I was looking to find things out of the box. Like, I felt like disenfranchised and not really, I didn't really believe in the robustness of the European economy almost at large. So I just had a really hard time buying blue chip stocks and or recommending them for my newsletter. So I felt like I had to find something else. And then, you know, doesn't take long to run into goals and be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. If there's like a reckoning and an inflationary crisis, then with gold, at least you maintain your purchasing power and you can buy things on the cheap. That's kind of the general strategy. If you have a very liquid asset in a period of deep crisis, then you are in the best position to then invest at the bottom when nobody else can buy because their money is stuck in the bank or they just need cash. But yeah, I mean, gold alone was just a bit, it just felt a bit too easy and too simple. So I just kept looking for things. And for a little while, I was like investigating this cold fusion scam that initially I thought was maybe real, like this Italian scientist, and you know, and eventually they were a scam, and luckily I identified it before I recommended anyone to invest. But so that was kind of the angle, was like, what is out there that nobody's looking at? Because all the newsletters I was looking at were like stock picking newsletters, so I felt like there has to be more. Once I found it, I wasn't sold immediately. I was mostly worried about how can you not just make more of it? Like, that was so, as soon as I really started grasping the actual scarcity aspect, that's when I started getting excited.
And so when did you sort of gather the confidence to go from adamant research to bringing in people's money and pitching Bitcoin to big?
Yeah, that's much later. Like, so yeah. Like the newsletter I did in 2011, and then, you know, I went full-time into Bitcoin from 2013 as an independent investor. And then I wrote my first adamant research reports around 2015. And I felt like I just had a lot to prove in terms of, you know, winning people's confidence and showing that I'm like long-term committed. And then also just to kind of still help myself understand the market better and kind of get to a place where I feel like I have something to offer that is maybe just really worthwhile. And then the fund really came out of the just wanting to do something that's an extension of what I'm already doing. So, I mean, the basic concept of a hedge fund is like, I think, managing money for friends. Like, that's kind of where it came from. And that's why hedge funds are kind of, you know, more private and not so, it's not a public offering, right? You don't promote it. And so, like, even in this podcast, like, I'm not going to say much more about it than that. That it's just like an extension of what I was already doing, and that feels very natural.
Yeah, no, and I mean, it seems like a very natural course of direction for you. Because again, thank you for all the content you put out over the years. Thank you for getting on Real Vision early and pitching the message there.
Yeah, that's been a fun ride. Yeah. By the way, I don't know if your listeners know, but Real Vision is like a Netflix for investors. Like, you pay once a year and then you get to listen to all these investors.
That's the funniest thing about your interviews on Real. If you go back and search Tour de Meester, it looks like you've been through a war since the first interview to now. Bitcoin has aged you. I think we were joking about this on Twitter.
Yeah, it looked like a very young Harry Potter, and now I'm like the weathered, beaten down, fire resistant Bitcoiner.
Mm-hmm. So, switching gears a little bit here, how'd you end up in Texas? Like, how did somebody from Europe end up in Austin, Texas, running a Bitcoin hedge fund?
Well, I mean, I think it's to some extent it's a new frontier, and I like to be where I think things are happening, and I really have a strong urge to get away from places that I feel like are more kind of sleepy or paralyzed or just like that. I just like the dynamism. The initial arrival in the US was more kind of vacation-y, but then we were more serious about it and we started thinking about where do we want to set up base, like what is going to be base camp for us, me and my wife. And really kind of did a pretty systematic overview, like kind of a systematic analysis of like, all right, well, what are our criteria? And then it was like, you know, I want a place where there's financial dealings happening, financial center, business center. I want technology. I want a good airport. And then eventually it was also like, huh, well, what about a mild winter? Like, that sounds nice. And then it's also like, you know, you want reasonable taxes and you want friendly people. And so, yeah, we tried a few places. We were traveling around. But then eventually just I think Texas is, even though it's booming, I think it's still undervalued and it has a lot more to come. And that's exciting.
Yeah.
And I love that it's in between both coasts. So you can just fly up and down very easily. Whereas like if you're in one of the corners, then, you know, going to the other corner is a lot further away.
Yeah, no, it's not fun going to LA from New York or SF from New York. It's
right.
A hell of a plane ride. No, there in this Texas, this is only my second time in Texas, and it's crazy the vibe here and the aurora of freedom that reigns free here. It's great.
Yeah, and there's a lot of history that kind of fits with that. I mean, it's the end of the Appalachian Trail, so these like early, well, actually not the earliest settlers, because they just kind of created New England, but then the ones that came a bit later, they were like not very welcome, and so they were just kind of pushed away, and every time they felt bugged by the you know, the guys that were setting up plantations in the south, or by like the more religious people that were north of them, they just kept going. And so eventually they ended up on the Texas plains, which was just very rough to cross because there was hardly any rain anymore, and the Comanche were there, and it was kind of, so that line between, you know, going down from Dallas, that line is like, and some places are called forts, like Fort Worth and other places, mm-hmm. was kind of the ultimate frontier. Is like you almost couldn't go any further without killing yourself. But yeah, and it was like people with big dreams came here. Like even before they knew about oil, it was still the idea that if you go further, you know, you can claim a bit of a bigger stake and really make a life for yourself, even though, you know, technically you're very poor, but at least. And it's also like, you know, they were traveling with their cattle and they had their whiskey. Like that was their portable wealth, which I think is just, yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, no, it's that was actually fascinating. Today, Tor and I were just at an event co-hosted by Adamant and Unchained Capital, and Gideon, who's speaking about mining, it just didn't come into my consciousness until he said this, but like 99.9% of the world's energy is run by monopolies, either controlled by the state or other types of entities, and Texas has just a pure unregulated grid, which is crazy to think that they can just have anybody own land. If they find energy, it's theirs, and they can do whatever they want with it.
Yeah, it's quite incredible. And obviously, it adds to the pleasure of living here is that energy prices are low because of all the competition, and there's just really an abundance of it. Very, yeah, interesting stuff. And yeah, I mean, there may be a future for mining here.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, I think there definitely is. But one thing, while I have you here, what I want to talk about is, again, your presentation at this little get together, the symposium, if you will, that we just came from. And I really like the parallels that you have found between the Reformation and Bitcoin in particular. And if you could sort of expound upon what you were saying earlier today.
Yeah, a little bit. It'll be like a sneak peek because I am going to be working on a report about it, because I think it's, you know, the thing with these historical analogies is that it's never perfect, and there's never going to be a repeat of history. But I do think that by studying history, you can kind of make connections that you otherwise would not. You can kind of connect things that are seemingly unrelated. And also you can sometimes just scratch away, possibly, you can just have a better idea of the probability of certain trends playing out and how one thing could be a catalyst for something else. So I guess to me, studying history is like a way to discipline myself on like, just not to get too crazy with extrapolation, because that can get you nowhere, I think. And I've made analogies in the past with like the petroleum discovery of petroleum versus the whale oil, which was a big industry at the time, how that was disrupted, and with the dot-com boom versus the crypto craze of 2017, and some other things. But this one I find really super fascinating, because the Reformation was this incredible, like just sweeping shift, like a shift of wealth, a shift of power, like the power balance was massively shifted. Also an enormous explosion of immigration. Like people were not only fleeing countries, but even like, you know, going to different continents for the first time ever in large amounts, in large, you know, large droves. And I've always tried to find things that would help me understand Bitcoin in the bigger picture. And so I feel like this is really something fascinating because there are some preconditions that are similar. So in the Reformation basically was, it refers to the desire of the merchant class who was emerging back then and other people to basically challenge the monopoly of the Catholic Church, because they had a monopoly on giving you the keys to heaven. Like, you know, if you wanted to go to heaven, you needed some kind of priest to tell you, like, it's fine, you're good, you have my blessing. And over time, that monopoly was, you could say, abused. They were basically charging more and more money to get into heaven. They would sell these indulgences, which then the church used to pay for very large projects like St. Peter's Cathedral and other things. And so people got, like, fed up with that. So that was the Reformation in the 16th century. And if you look at the preconditions, at least my interpretation of that, I see three. Like, one is there were some really incredibly impactful technological innovations at the time. There was the, you know, the invention of book printing, which, I mean, obviously all these things, the actual invention you could argue happened earlier, but really when it broke through and really kind of started becoming performant was the 15th century, 16th. So book printing and, you know, the Gutenberg printing press lowered the price of books from a year's wage to the price of a chicken. Like, it was incredible.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, over 100 years.
A book was a year's wage back
then? So yeah. I mean, you have to think, like, it was a manuscript. It was, like, meticulously hand-copied by a monk. Like, that was what was available. And then it was on animal hide. And, I mean, yeah, so very expensive. So all of a sudden that happened. So information all of a sudden was able to spread so quickly, and people were able to pseudonymously write pamphlets and stuff like that. So ideas were all of a sudden spreading a lot more quickly. So that's the first phase. And I think arguably now we're seeing something similar, where there's some really powerful technologies that are shifting things, like, I mean, encryption, social media, email, telecommunications, open source, the open source movement, the commoditization of computing power and computer storage, like information storage. All those things combined make it so much easier for individuals to work remotely, to set up startups, to basically disrupt the existing equilibrium. So that's the first. And then the second, I think, precondition is that you have wealth that's generated by these innovations, and that wealth is starting to get concentrated among a certain part of the population. So 16th century is the merchant class, which for the first time they had more and more means. And I think having financial means also means that you have an escape hatch, so you're more likely to speak up and protest, because, like Balaji has said in his presentation a few years ago, like, you can either voice, which is to speak or to protest, or you can exit. So if you have some money, then you actually even have the option to just move out if it gets difficult. So that is, and today, of course, I think the emerging new money is really the technology investors. Like, it's the .com billionaires, it's the cryptocurrency investors, like all those kind of people, I think are really a new generation. Not only, like, is the money passed on to them from older generation, but they've actually created and invested in new wealth. And then the last part, I think, that you need to have this, you know, basically ingredients for this explosive cocktail is for a rent-seeking monopoly, right? So you need a big monopolic service provider who is increasingly, you could say, exploiting the customers. And in the 16th century, it was like, yeah, you get your way into heaven, you always need to go through a priest or a church, and that's very expensive to get things done. And today, I mean, I would argue it's the fiat banking system, right? Which is, and the rent seeking is what Michael Goldstein was talking about earlier today, is the money printing, right? You just print money, and then even if you yourself didn't print the money, but you're the first to receive it, you can spend it at a higher purchasing power than the people who are going to receive the money later. So it's a taxation of the population. So it's rent seeking. And so I think that those three combined are really, and by the way, the last innovation I forgot to mention today is Bitcoin, obviously, right? Peer-to-peer technology, encryption, Bitcoin. But so I think all those three factors combined, you could argue that Bitcoin is really the catalyst for potentially a massive shift in the power balance of the world. It could bring about immigration flows. It could really make big changes happen, because similar to how the water was a moat, like in the 16th century, you could hide behind a big river and it was harder for armies to cross it, or you could cross an ocean and then set up shop there, stake your claim in the new world. I think similarly, today we have encryption and pseudonymity and those kind of things. So you can kind of instill that moat, not necessarily to do something evil, but just to say, I don't agree with the status quo. I want to bypass this monopoly service provider. I just want to do it my way. Please don't bother me. So that's kind of a defensive technology that I think is being used. So yeah, those are some of the thoughts that I shared today.
Yeah, no, it's very prescient, right? It is being involved in Bitcoin for as long as I have. It seems like common sense here, but like for most of the world, like pre-coiners, if you will, it's hard to get them to wake up and realize that they were born in a similar situation that the people living in the 16th century were in. And that's sort of, this is just a random tangent I'm going on here, and that's sort of what I try to do with the newsletter and this podcast is find little bits of information that can sort of open people's minds. I guess for you, when you're pitching Bitcoin to individuals and friends, what do you sort of focus on first, or what properties of Bitcoin or sort of the highest hit rate of people having an aha moment?
Right.
For you?
Well, I would say I first try to figure out what people need and what they're looking for, because I think Bitcoin has a lot to offer. And so, yeah, it really depends on where people are coming from. Like maybe they have family who lives abroad, and they, you know, the ability to send money without an intermediary is really powerful. Or they have lived in a country with high inflation before, and so they are always looking for a store of value. Or you know, they're an investor and they want to invest in what's new, and they want to know what millennials are going to be driving. Because by 2029, I think it's 2029 already, millennials will be the highest earning generation of our time. Like they will in the aggregate make the most money. So investors want to know, like, what are millennials going to buy? So I would argue that, you know, they're going to be a big driver of Bitcoin adoption as their earning power increases, because a lot of these people have never owned even blue chip stocks. Like this, they were just college age when the markets crashed, and then kind of lost faith in a lot of things, and so they're a lot more open to non-traditional investing, and they don't trust banks compared to older generations. So yeah, it really depends. Depends where people are coming from.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was just curious to hear what you're seeing out in the field, but let's go back to the conversation at the conference today. And actually, we're talking about your investment strategy, which is basically use Bitcoin to lever up to short the dollar, basically. So can you jump into the sort of mental framework behind the mindset of shorting the dollar with Bitcoin?
Yeah, I can't talk specifics about our strategy, but in general, if you have an asset that is liquid and that you believe has value for the long term, then it is very tempting to use it as a collateral to then do all kinds of activities with. People even do it with non-liquid assets. They use it, they do it with real estate. They do it with all kinds of things. And the nice thing about using Bitcoin as collateral is that the counterparty can basically engage in getting a secured loan from you, because the Bitcoin can actually be moved, and then they actually can see that the moment the value of the Bitcoin goes low enough, it will be liquidated and they will be compensated. So their risk is very low because it's such a liquid asset. And so I think over time that will cause the interest rates that you can get for lending out your Bitcoin to some extent or giving it up in collateral is going to be sharper than for some of these illiquid assets like real estate, of course, there's a big regulatory moat in favor of using real estate as collateral, you know. So that's going to have to be resolved over time. But in principle, I think it's very interesting. And then, yeah, once you borrow against that, then you can decide, like, can I find something that will give me a higher yield than the interest that I pay on the dollars? And, of course, it helps if those dollars slowly decrease in value and the assets that you're invested in, your collateral and your investments, both increase in value. So, yeah, that's kind of the idea behind such a strategy. And there's a bunch of other Bitcoin Alpha strategies out there that I think are interesting looking at. And it kind of depends on, you know, your fiscal situation, where you live, your appetite for risk, and then also your assessment about where we are in the market in terms of the phases of the market. I think all those play into what strategy to choose, like Bitcoin denominated loans or being active in the options market. You can also kind of have superior returns over Bitcoin, or obviously trading altcoins. I mean, a lot of people have done better than Bitcoin in 2016-17. After that, it's been a lot harder to outperform Bitcoin, but it's a strategy.
Yeah. No, I think one gentleman in the crowd just naturally recommended a speculative attack. Instead of levering up Bitcoin and dollars, using dollars, you use like a weaker currency to buy up Bitcoin and then lever up with Bitcoin and short that currency. It's not anything I would recommend people go run out and do.
Well,
it's just funny.
George Soros, it's a page out of George Soros's book, right?
Yeah.
Where basically I think the idea is that if you go short that currency, say that it's like the Suriname, I don't know what currency they have there, but imagine that currency. So you borrow a huge amount of it and then you sell it, and then you obviously have a debt denominated in that currency. After selling, you go to a stronger currency, and the idea is that you basically, it's already a weak market, but your massive intervention breaks the camel's back, and that's the deluge, that's the start of the breakdown, that's what George Soros nailed with the British pound when he did that. It's not that, you know, he alone caused it to break, it's that it was already weak and he kind of gave it a little kick.
Less snowflake on the avalanche,
right,
if
right.
you will.
But I mean, this is part of why the IMF was brought into life. It's to help countries protect themselves against potential speculative attacks like that. So that's why the IMF has a pool of currencies that can be used to shore up a small currency against an attack like that.
But all this...
But to follow that logic, so you could make an argument that maybe the IMF needs to buy Bitcoin so that they can defend against a Bitcoin-fueled speculative attack on another currency.
That is a tidbit I did not think of.
That's been around since 2013. I think somebody wrote a paper about
Pierre, that. Pierre wrote that. I didn't know the IMF was involved with this, but it does sort of beg the question, like if there a speculative attack does happen, you become to a Bitcoin standard, it really highlights the harsh reality that we're living in a currency system based on barter. Right, so you're bartering between currencies, really, when you're doing international trade and stuff like that. At the end of the day, would you agree with that semantically?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm not really up to date on the definition of barter, strictly speaking. I think it means like you trade with non-fungible goods, but I do think that maybe you're right. Maybe smaller currencies are actually not that fungible at all, especially if you're talking about large amounts of money.
Yeah, no, just trying to itch at the point that like it would be great to have sort of like a metric system of value in money, and wouldn't it be
that is very primitive, that we have all these like hundreds of currencies, and like it's pretty much a nightmare for everyone traveling basically these like mini taxation systems, right? They're all tax farms, like they're all like, you know, if you print the local currency, then it's like what Argentina is doing. Like, why is Argentina in this crazy inflationary environment? It's because the government has been printing money, right? They've been trying to pay their bills, and they've been probably having some socialist expansionary policies, and then they tax their people that way. So it's not really a system that's designed for the common good. It's designed for the good of the government that's running the scheme.
Yeah, no, I mean, Argentina, what, they issued 100-year bonds 2 years ago, maybe?
And yeah, and everybody thought, like, oh, they're Wall Street guys in charge now, they'll do a good job, and people are buying it, and I guess the bet is not paying off.
No, and you have, like, I was telling Parker this earlier, I was working out yesterday, I don't watch CNBC that often, but I just had it on in the gym because the market's been volatile this week, and there was two or three instances where two people seriously suggested that the U.S. issue 50 and 100-year bonds. And to me...
1,500?
No, 50 and 100-year.
Oh, but even so.
Yeah.
Wow.
So to me, that signals sort of desperation. Do you think I'm correct in assuming that?
I mean, it's a dead-end street. It's absolutely a dead-end street. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, like, in the Middle Ages and later, what you had was basically perpetual bonds. So you would... Not even bonds, really, because there were some religious reasons why a bond was considered to be not kosher and not, like, I think it had to do with the idea that charging interest on money, mm-hmm. that was, like, usury and you shouldn't do that. Governments would issue annuities, so you would give them money now, and they would, like, just pay you interest on a phantom loan. So you would never get the principal back, but in perpetuity, they would pay you back interest, which is kind of like a 100-year bond or something. It's almost like forever. But of course, if you take on enough of that debt, eventually you just default, and that's what's going to happen around the world as well. Yeah. Unless, of course, you manage to debase your own currency enough, so then it becomes super easy to pay off your debt with worthless currency. And yeah. I think that's the defaults we're going to go to. Like, we're not going to see genuine defaults. We're going to see default by proxy, which means, you know, just very high inflation.
Devaluation.
You're going to devalue the debt away.
Yeah. So staying in this vein, I guess, like, how do you see this playing out? Do you see currency by currency falling, or do you see sort of like a global crisis where a lot of markets fall at once? Is this going to be slow and somewhat less painful transition, or do you think the state of the current financial system around the world is such that it needs an abrupt sort of punch in the arm?
There's this quote by an economist called, I think he's called Rüdiger Dornbusch, and he was in, I believe he was in Mexico at the time of the peso crisis. Before that, he was there, and then during it, and it was something like, he said that it happened, it was just so slowly. It was so slowly, and then it happened all at once. Like, it's very sudden. And it kind of has to do with the panic that comes with, you know, all of a sudden the masses are, like, panicking, and people want to exit, and then by definition, you all get stuck at the exit, and you can't. Your money gets stuck in the bank, and the banks are closed down, and all of a sudden international investors are dumping the currency. But to me, it's hard to see it all collapse at the same time. I think the dollar has this exorbitant privilege of being, you know, the currency of the world. And so I think that it's going to be used and seen as a safe haven for quite a while. So in a way, like, sitting in a dollar-based economy, I think we'll get to witness the collapse of several currencies before maybe the dollar will devalue as well.
Yeah. No, I think I agree with that notion. I mean, we're seeing right now, like, Argentine peso collapsed by 25% earlier this week. Looks like the Hong Kong dollar is losing its peg to the dollar.
I wonder what's going to happen there. Because, like, it looks like there's just, I don't know how many tanks were standing ready to roll in. It could be that it'll be like a Crimea situation where they just annex it or something.
On the car ride over here, there was video of the tanks moving into Hong Kong, not on the border anymore. So yeah, that's a crazy situation, and like to think.
And then it happened so fast. I mean, it was only like 2 years ago that, like, Hong Kong was just the ultimate place to be, and the real estate is booming, and wow.
The last 3 months in particular, just complete deterioration.
Yeah. And in some way, you could argue, like, you know, going back to the Reformation, is that it's like these are political powers who are very attached to their monopolistic privileges of, you know, money printing and economic stimulus and kind of manipulation, and then seeing that Hong Kong is used as a platform for capital flight, they really don't like that. They can't, and so they're trying to dam off, like, to kind of prevent the dam from breaking.
Well, that's the interesting part of this particular situation, because it's 2019, you have the ability to watch these protests in real time via Periscope and live streams, and you have basically the world watching this little island south of China, and if I'm the Chinese government, you know that every eye's on you. Like, how do you even act in this situation?
Yeah, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, right? I think they're kind of really in a very, I mean, from their point of view, in a very unenviable position, because if they don't act, then the capital flight is probably just going to, you know, it's going to accelerate. But if they do act, they kind of chase the money out of Hong Kong anyway. So it's kind of like, is it going to be, you know, maybe if they kind of do rush in and it's like a Crimea thing, maybe they can like slow down the capital flight, and which is from a political point of view, maybe what you want to do, because most politicians don't think in the very long term. They're more like, can I save my skin for the next 5 years? So maybe that's what's happening.
Yeah, no, it's it'll be interesting to see what plays out there and how people react, because we were talking about this at the symposium earlier today. That's, are people in these countries with capital flight buying Bitcoin? Like, do you think there is any flows from these capital centers into Bitcoin? And brought up the fact that a couple of people point at the exchanges in China and say that they're trading at a discount, but then you brought up a good point about Tether and the addiction to Tether in Asia in particular, and that may sort of hide the exchange discounts may sort of underscore the underlying demand that's there.
Yeah, the idea is that maybe they're paying a premium to buy the Tether, and then with the Tether, they're just kind of the peer of everybody else, because everybody's using Tether to buy stuff on Binance, etc. Probably also Bitfinex. But, I mean, even so, we're still not at, like, tsunami levels of capital flight, right? Otherwise, Bitcoin would be at 100,000 or higher. Like, it's still probably mostly fleeing the dollar and using the traditional means to protect themselves.
Yeah.
Or you know, foreign assets, you know, foreign real estate or something like that.
Well, that was the most interesting part of Hong Kong, because it's like one of the highest end real estate markets in the world, and you have China coming down there. Where does all that capital go? Like, you're actually seeing like cities like New York, Vancouver, San Francisco sort of constrict regulations there after years and years of capital flight into their real estate markets, and people are finally starting to wake up and be like, hey, like, where does that Hong Kong money go?
And then also, if you have a currency crisis in Asia, then that could mean that all of a sudden all these investors and family offices are short of cash, and then they need to start liquidating their foreign real estate to just, you know, keep the lights on. So you could see a ripple effect in Western markets too, I think.
Yeah. We live in very interesting times. We have 10 minutes left here before you have to leave for this beautiful bus service that you keep shilling to me. Apparently I have to move down to Texas for the buses.
It's all about barbecue, amazing weather, except for 2 months. I think one thing is also that I think there's a nice humidity, whereas like you only appreciate it once you go to very dry areas and you're kind of like coughing at night and your eyes are all sandy. It's something really nice about having like a warm, humid evening, things like that.
Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of watching a thunderstorm on a porch or something on a cabin night. Mm-hmm. Before we let you go, what are your current thoughts on the current state of the Bitcoin protocol from like a technical perspective? What are
it's
you?
It's terrible. It's teetering. Just, you know, it's about to break. Give it another few months. I'm kidding. But do finish your question.
I was going to say, is there anything you're looking out for in particular? Anything you're excited for in particular? As somebody who has to custody Bitcoin, as somebody has to...
Yeah. So things that excite me in the Bitcoin space, like, I mean, it's actually really nice that a lot of the noise has like died down and there's a renewed, genuine focus on Bitcoin from investors. Like, I feel like I have a lot less explaining and defending to do when it comes to Bitcoin, with the dominance at 70%. I mean, it kind of speaks for itself. So that's nice. I think that institutions are getting in and are wanting to get better. Insurance, legal custody solutions. And so I think that there's really interesting stuff happening in derivatives markets, which, you know, there's, you know, you can get exposure to Bitcoin by proxy, which is, I think, totally fine, as long as it's a transparent contract. But also more sophisticated setups for custody with not only multi-sig, but only adding the, also adding the time element, where you have these really interesting ways to, as an owner of the coin, to still retain ultimate control, even though you defer responsibility and signing power to some other parties. So I think that's going to be super powerful. I think asset issuance in Bitcoin, I think, is still underestimated. Like, people think like, oh, Ethereum has, they have their whole ICO thing going and tokens, and that's their spiel. Like, I think you haven't seen anything yet. I think we're going to see pretty amazing token issuance happen. Not that I'm a super fan of it. Like, I think a lot of it is going to be garbage. But I do like the idea of having a market that is based in Bitcoin technology and that's probably also going to be traded in Bitcoin, like Bitcoin-denominated settlement.
Well, I don't know if you've been paying attention to this in particular with Liquid, but Liquid Tether, some people are saying that Liquid Tether may have just made, like, the first, like, large dark pool in crypto trading history, because that's, like, the one bad thing about trading between exchanges right now is that you can get, like, whale calls on Twitter just, like, showing that you're moving your Bitcoin to a new wallet. And, like, as a trader, like, what the fuck? Like, everybody can see that I'm trading right now. And
yeah, people can front run you and all that.
And so, like, now with Tether on Liquid combined with confidential transactions, you can just see how much money is being moved. You can't see from where and to where. You just know that, that a lot is moving.
Yeah, and Blockstream doesn't look so stupid now anymore, right? People are often being like, oh, like, very critical and like, oh, why do you want to do all that confidentiality? And it's like, well, there's perfectly economic investment related reasons to want to do that. It's not because they're crazy libertarians. It's just the way markets want to operate.
Yeah. You want to be able to move money between exchanges pretty quickly to trade, and to trade with a certain amount of privacy.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Last question before we go out here. What do you think the next cycle? Like, we just had ICOs, like 2017. We've had, before that, you had like fair POW launch coins and then like first generation POS coins, quote unquote. Like, I am under the belief that you're not going to see, like, a huge ICO rally like we did in 2017 again. Like, I think the market has wised up a bit, and a lot of people are saying, like, IEOs may be the next iteration of like, the dumb money and the pumpable stuff. Like, I don't think we're going to have as severe pumps in alternative markets as we have in the past. Do you agree with that?
I agree, and I think it's time for a comeback of the national coins. Spain coin, Dutch coin, the Dutch Guilder.
Well, PBOC came out. Bring it on. I think they're making one, right?
China coin. No, I'm kidding, of course. No, I'm kidding. Although, actually, I do think that I've said this before, that we're moving into the hold my beer phase for large banks, large corporations, nation states to launch their own currencies. And I think they'll be bad investments, but I do think they're really going to try to do that to kind of compete with Bitcoin or try to challenge it. Which, you know, going to our reformation analogy, is like the counter-reformation. It's like the answer of the church to all this stuff. I think I'm super bullish on the Bitcoin lending market, super bullish on the Bitcoin derivatives market. Like, really, this is the bottom layer of this gigantic stack, and it's just so underestimated how much can be built on top of Bitcoin. Because that's the thing, if you have a solid basis, you can build really, really high, and people have been underestimating the value of this, an ossified protocol at the bottom of something that, you know, as a foundational layer. People have kind of seen Bitcoin as slow and boring, and well, that's exactly what it needs to be the foundation for a lot more.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect place to end it. You have a bus to catch. Thank you for tapping me on the shoulder.
Thanks, Marty. It was fun.
Yeah, this is always fun. Cool. Hopefully I see you soon. I don't know what your travel plans are, but I'm sure we'll run into each other at some point.
Yep, we will.
Peace and love, freaks.